Today is the 24th of July, 2024, and the time is 10:36 a.m. My name is Preeti Srivenkacham, and I'm conducting the fourth session of an interview for the Making of Indian Conservation Project over Zoom with Zai Whittaker. I'm currently in Bangalore, and she's at the Madras Crocodile Bank Trust near Chennai. As always, thank you so much for agreeing to this session. And
Right.
in today's session, I'm hoping we could cover some of your reflections on India's conservation history and your vision for the future and what you think is going to happen. So my first question would actually be that if you were to reflect on the time period since 1972, what, in your opinion, are some of the major successes in India's wildlife conservation past?
Well, I think that was the time when the foundation of Conservation India was set. So before that, it was, there was a pretty stark switch from hunting to conservation. And there were also, this is, I mean, there are examples of this even with human beings like Jim Corbett and Salim Ali, who started out EPG, Kenneth Anderson. They started out as hunters and then there was a switch to conservation. So, in a way, that is a metaphor for what the country also went through. And when we were doing our first crocodile surveys, for example, we routinely ran into crocodile hunters.
Which year was this?
This was 74, 74, 75, 76 were the early crocodile survey years. So what I was saying is that those years, that early 70s was when the foundation was set and a lot happened. WWF started in India. Many very important naturalists came to India, people like George Schaller and Steve Berwick, Paul Josselin for the Gir Lions, partly because of my father's initiatives. I would say fully, because there were people in the government, very strong voices, who felt that we don't need foreigners, we can do it all. And they were very resentful of foreign naturalists coming here and telling us what to do. But in fact, it was those foreign naturalists who played a very major role. So I think kind of internationalizing conservation was very difficult and brought him a lot of enemies. But I think that was a very good step that my father and actually the WWF team together took. So that was one success, I think. And the other is that a lot of small initiatives began, mostly bird-centric, bird-watching groups. But of course, then it sort of bird-watching always spreads out into animal-watching and forest-watching and conservation. So these little groups are started all over the country. And again, excuse me for going back to my father, but his little newsletter for bird watchers played a very big role. And people like Ram Guha, for instance, talk about how he got interested in conservation and conservation writing because he wrote for the newsletter and Baba published it, as in Cyclostyle Lit. And Ram was a young boy at that time, and it meant a lot to him that he was published in the newsletter. So through the newsletter, through bird watching, Lots and lots of small conservation-minded groups grew up in different parts of the country. And that was a big success because there were these voices all around, and it just really, it wasn't just the Delhi voice anymore.
You'd mentioned that you're even currently involved with a newsletter. I think you'd said it was online now. Do you think that these days newsletters and the impact that they have are in any way different from back then?
Well, there's newsletter is kind of an archaic word now, so you would be talking about blogs and vlogs and things like that. In those days, it was the printed word. And I actually brought the newsletter culture to the Snake Park when I moved there in 74, and we started Hamer Dryad. I think we spoke about that earlier. Anyway, I think the newsletter and WWF played a major role in creating this awareness all over the country and setting an overall vision for conservation. And because IUCN was also involved, again, because of my father, there was a conversation early on about sustainable conservation, about sustainable use of wildlife. And, these are things we still discuss and talk about. So, in terms of failures,
Yeah, that was going to be my next question.
When I was in college, the population of this country was half of what it is today. So it was a very different country, and our wild spaces were very different, and tourism was very different. So that has been a huge failure of not being able to control our population. And again, my parents and many friends were volunteers in the family planning initiatives, which were started in those days, late 1960s, I guess. And there was a lot of hope, but all that disappeared.
So could you share some more detailed examples about the failures of tourism that you're referring to?
Of tourism.
Yeah, what is it that you're referring to when you say failures of tourism?
No, I'm talking about the failures of family planning now,
Okay.
of population control. So we have way too many people, and that's a huge failure.
Okay.
And when we could have done something about it, we didn't. So now, whether it's a park or a national park or whatever it is, sanctuary, city, open spaces in the cities, there's just too many people, and the environment is being destroyed because of numbers. Now, there are some initiatives, like recently, it's good to know that Kodaikanal, the hill station, which has been trashed by tourists. They are doing a motor vehicle survey to see how many cars go up the hill. And the plan is, I believe, that they will then do a study to see what the sustainable number is for the town in terms of water, in terms of, the carbon footprint, basically. So these are all good initiatives that are happening. But it needs to be done on a much bigger scale, and we need to focus on ecology and not economy. I mean, at least equally, and also understand that one depends on the other to a large extent.
Are there any other things you would attribute as being some major failures in the past?
Well, I think we all know that our environmental impact assessments should be way, way better, should be carried out by honest and competent ecologists and scientists. They should not be overruled by political forces. So that's the main thing now that, we have to look at that very, very carefully.
And with regard to reptile conservation in particular, would you say there are some successes and failures that you've witnessed?
I think they go with cons I mean they go with all the other animals in conservation. So you have forests, you preserve them. You have reptiles as well, and we have some of the rarest species in the world. But also the thing about reptiles is that they are very directly economically beneficial to us. Like if you try to convince people that a tiger is economically beneficial, then it's difficult. But snakes and a lot of other reptile groups as well, they eat rats. I mean, a lot of rats. So they're of great economic importance to the country. And one of the ways of preserving them is to convince people that not every snake is out to bite you and envenomate you. Not all snakes are venomous, and that they are very good for the farmer and therefore for us. So, like we have the snake bite mitigation project at the Crop Bank, and again, it's something that's spreading all over the country. We have partners in many other states as well now who are creating public awareness about the prevention and treatment of snake bite. Mostly, we are focusing on prevention. Because, there are issues with anti-venom distribution and production. So the best thing is don't get bitten. So that's our message. And we're putting a lot of time and resources into this project.
Any other successes or failures that you would like to reflect on? Anything related to writing for children, you think?
Well, I think that no, not for about writing, but I think that to educate politicians is really important. It's something we started doing in WWF India in Bombay in the early days. We had a slideshow. In those days, there were no PPTs, but there were slideshows. So, there was a one slideshow called Drought and Flood, I remember. And we gathered together local officers, local politicians, panchayat people, and talked to them
When would this
about
have been?
late 60s when I was helping out with WWF. So we would get government people together and talk to them about conservation, about things like erosion, about building in the wrong places, building with the wrong materials, what brick kilns do to water bodies, why water bodies are important, why forests are important, and so on. So I think that really needs to be done on a much bigger scale, not just as token talks at the Missouri Academy, but to like grassroots people who are making these decisions.
My next question, I think you've already started answering a bit of it, but the next question was about what is your vision for the future of wildlife conservation in India? So if you would just like to add on about probably more aspects that you think are key in your ideal scenario of things.
Well, these two are definitely ones that I think would go a long way towards improving the situation if done with passion and motivation, to educate our politicians. And I can't, I mean, at the moment, and of course, the impact assessments, they are absolutely focal to doing anything meaningful or stopping terrible things from happening.
What do you think could be done differently or better regarding them?
Well, just do them. I mean, I don't know how the political system works, but I'm sure they can figure it out. Take what we started on to a much bigger level. So that panchayat presidents, for example, are educated. My vision at the moment is not very hopeful for the country. But as I said earlier, I think there are small pockets of hope, and that is what we all have to hang on to. For example, I think Tamil Nadu is really taking a lead in water conservation. A lot of cleaning and desilting is being done for water bodies, and we've had some good decisions about forests as well. So, yeah, there are parts of the country which are looking at it more seriously. But I mean, I was recently in Nagarhole, and we went on a drive through the national park, and just simple things like the speed at which the park vehicles themselves travel through. They don't regulate blasting your horn enough. When you look at these wild, so-called wildlife videos, it's just endless what horrible things tourists do within national parks. And we're not able to control it.
How do
So,
you feel it could be controlled?
well, I don't know. I'm not a management, wildlife management expert, but there are many who are.
Anything else you would like to add regarding your vision?
No, but to reiterate, I don't have all these all these answers, but we have a lot of good people who could be pulled in to do these things, so use them or bring them in from other countries and, make these things work. People like me just know that, well, this isn't working. But we also know that it is working in other places. So why be chary of bringing in experts if we don't have them? But actually, we do, just a matter of organization.
Something additionally that I was hoping to get your views on was how you view the place of different forms of knowledge in conservation, such as formal scientific, indigenous, experiential, and the relationships between them.
Yeah, so I think a really wonderful example of that, these levels of biodiversity knowledge, is South Africa, because they have some of the best ecologists and biologists in the world who are working on, for example, the carrying capacity of national parks like the Kruger of elephants, for example. And then you have the local tribes who are given jobs in the park and important jobs which are respected and well paid, who are the ones who may take tourist groups out into the park or hold training workshops for younger people in the tribe, or work with crafts people to make souvenirs, to sell in the park. And the middle group is the tourists themselves, which give a lot of feedback, and that's taken very seriously. So, I would say that that is an ideal model to follow.
And with regard to your work in particular with reptiles, do you think there is anything better that could be done in the future than what has been happening till now?
Well, to go back to snake conservation, which, as I said, also has great economic value for us, the government is now, we are now pushing several groups in the government to take this on and to network with ecologists, with government, with doctors, for the treatment of snake bite, primary health centers. And recently there's been some pretty focal meetings about that organized by government, which we have been part of. So that is happening.
This is a central government or state government level?
Central. But state governments also have started these conversations, and I think it's a very good way to go. As far as crocodile conservation is concerned, our water bodies are being so invaded by human settlements that rewilding is, as we thought till about 20 years ago would be a possibility, is not. So going forward, crocodiles are going to survive in these vast habitats, maybe like the Chambal National Park, the Tri-State Park for the Gharial, or in zoos. So that's quite sad because they're an important part of the, whole ecological change. But I think we also have to change our ideas a little bit because of the human presence everywhere now. The other thing that's happening with reptiles, again initiated by us and again at a very small level, is we're encouraging states to set up something called reptile conservation alliances, which are reptile zoos. And this will make a big difference and help to focus on reptiles as an animal group that also needs to be conserved. Apart from the fact that, they're fun to watch.
I think the other question that I have is aside from your vision, what do you foresee as the future of wild species and spaces? Maybe what do you actually think will end up happening aside, I mean, the vision aside, and linked to that, what gives you worry, what gives you hope when you think about the future?
Well, it's becoming harder and harder to hang on to the worry, I mean, to the hope, and easier to worry from what we see. At the same time, it's important to continue working in this area, and you can only work if you have hope. So, again, I hang on to the small initiatives that are that haven't given up. Little places like the Andaman Network, the Croc Bank, Kalpavrishk, WWF. You know, in the face of many odds, these people have all continued to hammer away at the message and try and get some positive action from the government. So, I think that's the way I do it, is I hold on to some piece of good news that I read or hear about, and I make sure that it's way up here rather than down here. And that's the way I can function, I think. But otherwise, yeah, I see wildlife more and more just in a few protected areas. More and more animal conflict, even in the cities, like elephants and leopards at traffic junctions, waiting for the lights to change. And that is something that for me is really hard, because it affects the poorest of our poor. And I've been to places where elephants have come and overnight trampled down a small little subsistence farm of sugarcane owned by a tribal family in the Javadi Hills. We were trying to get them some compensation, because a woman was killed who was watching the field at night. And that also is such a bureaucratic and convoluted process of red tape that, you know, they. And finally, the sum is so small that it's just heartbreaking. So we have to bridge this gap of people like me sitting in our armchairs and saying, no, we must save the elephant. And that lady who was killed and her family.
With
When
regard to
there are nuisance animals, I think our forest department has to get better at removing them. And that would, I mean, the bison in Kodaikanal, for instance, it's something we can do. You know, we can, when they started coming into the town, if at that point, maybe in the late 80s, I can't remember, those few animals had been translocated and, you know, kept out of the town area. Then children in some of those villages would still be able to go to school. Now they're not, because they're poor, there's no transport where they live, and they have to walk down paths where there are bisons. So, yeah, there's still a lot we can do if we have the will. But we're not doing it. There's a lot for which it's too late, like the human population, but there's a lot that it's not too late for.
Such as.
Well, as I said, just, you know, this animal conflict.
With regard to tribal populations and indigenous communities and their involvement in conservation, how do you foresee the future?
Again, I would say that a lot is possible, Preeti, but I'm not a sociologist. So I would say that there's a lot that can be done because a lot of these groups have traditional knowledge, have skills, have experiences that can be used in the mainstream economic market, if you will. But there's no will to do it. You know, the Irulas have the skill with snakes. They're extracting venom and selling it. Similarly, other groups, also have a lot of possibilities. But bring together a group of experts, economists, scientists, anthropologists, and make it work similarly for each of those groups. Whichever groups are interested, so that things are not thrust on them. And we don't see wonderful forest biologists and naturalists breaking stones on the road. Totally possible, but we don't want it.
Is there anything else regarding conservation that you feel we have not covered so far that you would like to speak about?
I would like to stress this point again, both in terms of conservation, wildlife protection, and all that, as well as indigenous people, because these are the two things that really interest me. And I see more and more the potential, when you bring the right people together, have meaningful conversations. And the government takes it forward with motivation and will, because sometimes it happens to a certain level and then you drop the ball. Very often that happens because, of this transfer word. Some one person is interested, starts some initiative, and then is transferred to textiles or something like that. So again, it's entirely possible if there's a will. It's very possible.
If there is nothing else that you would like to add, we could wind up the session, or you can let me know if there's something additionally you feel that we've missed out on.
No, I think I've, been able to speak about several things that are of interest to me and also kind of validate what I feel my family and the early WWF team put in motion. I think that is really important, especially my sister's contribution. And my father's, of course. So that's been good. And yeah, thank you for giving me this opportunity, Preeti.
Thank you for sharing all your thoughts.
Okay.
I'll just stop the recording.
Okay.